we're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here, looking in the mirror.
Everybody just do your job! You understand that?
Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Alex, the NCAA is in peril. It's at a crossroads. It's never been less healthy. Why, you might ask, old friend? It's because the Final Four ratings are going to be terrible. FAU's in the Final Four. San Diego State's in the Final Four. Not great brands. The ratings are going to be awful. You're going to hear a lot of sports media types saying that the ratings are going to be awful. You know what, Alex? You don't have to care. You don't have to care at all. It is, in my professional opinion, that unless you are an executive for one of the companies advertising at the Final Four or for the NCAA, you do not ever have to care about the TV ratings of anything. Granted, college basketball ratings were fine across the board, even up as far as the men's are concerned, even though, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, men's college basketball, at least, does not really have that standout player during its regular season. Obviously, tournament creates narratives. We found one in Marquise Noel with Kansas State, for instance.
No, I completely agree with you. I think that it is simultaneously true that college basketball has been a big loser from talent shifting away from it over the years and a lot of the best players no longer being in college basketball for even 1 year, let alone two or three or four. All the stuff we talked about before the tournament, how we think the sport has probably lost some juice to college football and to the NFL and to other year-round sports now, I think is all true. And yet, I just cannot bring myself to care that ticket prices are low, like that ratings are maybe going to be low. Like, I think it is cool that FAU and San Diego State are in a Final Four, that includes not a single not only does the Final Four not include a number one seed, but in a year where the Elite Eight didn't even have a one seed, I find it to be a lean-in opportunity. Like, this is a sport already that, given where we've been the last 10-15 years, it's a one-month sport where people want to watch chaos. They want to watch bloodshed.
I will say this. My bracket challenge, I'm literally the bit. Like, my girlfriend, who will not and has not watched a college basketball game maybe ever, is probably going to win our bracket challenge.
Winner. She's smart. I've met her. She knows what she's doing.
Like it, I'm telling you, watch less college basketball. You'll be fine in your bracket challenge.
Richard, we will come back to the organization that puts on March Madness, the NCAA, in a little bit. We are going to do sort of a surveying of the landscape there because it is a busy time right now, and especially this week for the, you know, existential future of college sports questions that tend to get asked like every 3 minutes now over the last few years. But first, some news of the week. In fact, we'll keep it with something basketball adjacent to start, though we're not going to do another accidental basketball episode. The San Diego State Aztecs, as I mentioned, are in the Final Four. They, after years and years of kind of butting their head against the plexiglass of the NCAA tournament and losing in the early rounds and having a good team but not getting far, they have capitalized on this chaos here. They're going to play in a national semifinal on Saturday night against Florida Atlantic. Another incredible story. And San Diego State's presence in this basketball tournament and their deep run has prompted a new round of boosterism, I would say, for SDSU to get a call to join the Pac-12 Conference, the Conference of Champions. John Canzano and John Wilner, the two Johns who we have mentioned a few times on this program, the two, I would say, most plugged in Pac-12-specific reporters out there in the world, are both beating this drum loudly now, saying that the Pac-12 should get off the pot and invite San Diego State to join. And while I do not think it is generally good policy to add a school to a conference because they have just had a great run in the basketball tournament, you know, the ACC didn't add George Mason after 2006. The Big Ten did not add Loyola Chicago after 2018.
This is not that. This is decidedly different than that.
Agreed. Why don't you tell the listeners how it is different than that?
Well, I think it's different than that in two things. Like, first of all, you know, we've been talking about San Diego State maybe getting added to the Pac-12 for what, like a month and change now, as far as like in earnest, like really happening. You know, we did a Patreon show. I can't do, we did a Patreon show about that. That went into some depth about that. I like, I don't think this is some weird, like they're in the Final Four. Like San Diego State has possibly never had this much of a spotlight on its school. There are some people who are going to, right. There are going to be some people who are going to realize that San Diego State exists for the first time. This, I'm not kidding, because some people last weekend figured out FAU exists for the first time. So yes, there are some people who are going to be like, oh, San Diego State's in the, in that part of the country. USC's going to the, you know, it may make sense. I don't think this is a plant. I don't think this is anything like that. Like it's, I get it from a, hey, San Diego State's never had more notoriety. Let's discuss whether they fit, when they fit, et cetera, et cetera. By the way, it's the end of March. You will note, my good friend, the Pac-12 does not have an announcement of a television deal or a television rights agreement, even though two of its, well, one president and one commissioner, Ray Anderson and Kirk Schultz of Washington State, Ray Anderson of Arizona State, came out, about a month ago now, and said that the deal was going to be done by mid-March. It is not.
Also, some would not note awesome. That, some would note I, that 2 weeks ago, Richard, when we last recorded on this feed, I said, please, Pac-12, put us out of our misery. It has not yet happened. The carousel still goes round.
I don't say that to say they're not going to get it done. I say that to say that it's not done yet. And it's not the most awesome strategy from a narrative setting perspective for your conference to not say anything, then say something that has turned out to be, I think, wide of the mark by about a month, because it seems like we're going to get into April here, probably around mid-April when this thing's actually going to get done.
It's been a saga, but I think that ultimately, despite the kind of funny timing of, oh, they're in the Final Four, let's add them to the league. I agree that the Pac-12 should add San Diego State. I think that they are by far the most natural fit for a realignment bump up that we have seen since the couple of American schools went to the Big 12 a couple of summers ago at this point, or a couple of falls ago at this point. They are really good at men's basketball, and they have been for a while, even though they did not get over the hump until this year. They are pretty good at football and have been pretty good at football under a couple of head coaches in a row. They would presumably get a lot better if they were recruiting to the Pac-12 rather than the Mountain West. And they're good at other sports. And this is the thing that we've talked about with the Pac-12 before, Richard, about, you know, in the context of like Colorado and why the Pac-12 might have been an attractive place for Colorado to go a decade ago. San Diego State has some really good Olympic sports. And I guess baseball is an Olympic sport now too. I mean, they are really, really good at baseball. Tony Gwynn, Steven Strasburg, Mark Grace. They are sometimes very good in women's basketball. I did not this. Now we're getting into the area where I did just do some quick research yesterday. They have good histories in golf and track. No, I was not an authority on San Diego State golf and track. I had to look that up before we recorded this episode. But I think they will fit in fine. And I don't know, like, you're always in the tank for San Diego. It's just like whether they change, whether they significantly alter the financial calculus for the league or not, which I suspect they probably are not going to make everybody rich, because everyone knows San Diego State is not USC or UCLA. It's not like you just swap out SoCal for SoCal. It's pleasant to be in Southern California. It's good for a league to be in Southern California. And so
it's good for me. It's good for me personally to cover Oregon versus San Diego State. I would tell you that. It is fantastic for my personal brand.
I think that you will have a wonderful time. You will eat great food. You will enjoy watching games in that nice new stadium that they built, even though that stadium seems to lack sun cover. Did you know that? I remember after their first game last year new stadium, there was a viral TikTok about how they just like did not have enough cover for the sun in San Diego. Granted, it's not always that hot in San Diego. Got some pushback on that from SDSU alums. Yeah, but
the thing with San Diego is it's literally perfect. Like the weather is dude, I went to San Diego on a golf trip with the boys. You go to the beach and we were there on like a Wednesday, dude. And you're like, does anybody work around here? Because you guys know from Florida, like I know what tourists look like at the beach, and I know what like people who live in said beach town look like at the beach. You can tell, man. And you're like, y'all don't work around here? Y'all just out here jogging on the beach Wednesday at like 11:30? Nobody has a job. Everybody's just dedicated to physical fitness and beautiful. San Diego's tremendous.
They're
tremendous.
They're all very physically fit. That's what they say. Yeah, so San Diego State, I think the Pac-12 should go ahead and do it. It's not a chess piece. I don't think it's going to save the league. And by the reason that I say that is that I think the Pac-12's fate is sort of left to the gods anyway. Like, in a couple of years, the Big Ten might come knocking for your remaining big fish, or it might not. And either way, like, I don't know that San Diego State changes that, but sometimes life's too short and you should just add a good competitor to your league when you can, especially when they're located in San Diego. And if it changes the media rights by, you know, a couple million dollars per school, well, great. And if it doesn't, then at least they're probably not costing you a ton of money. I don't think that you're going to lose a ton of money by sharing the pie with one more school that happens to be in San Diego. Richard, let's go from one beautiful scenic region of the country to another. Wow, I'm going to get in trouble for this one.
I've often said the San Diego, Columbus, Ohio, the San Diego of the Midwest.
So Michigan is recruiting very well right now in the state of Ohio. Four-star running back Jordan Marshall from Cincinnati committed the other day and appears to have had a serious Ohio State offer, like with Tony Alford and Brian Hartline legitimately trying to land him, according to the major recruiting services.
Also, by the way, according to me.
According to you. And, like, maybe it's worth explaining that, like, not every time you see, like, a check mark next to this school offered on 24/7, that doesn't always mean that the school, like, offered with a capital O. Like, I understand that. And it tends to happen that when certain schools lose certain players to certain rivals, they pretend they didn't want them that bad. I think Ohio State actually wanted this player and Michigan got him.
It is my understanding that Ohio State wanted this player.
Okay.
I will say this, but to your point about, you know, offers and the differences. Look, man, sometimes you got to offer a kid that you don't want to offer to get his homie. Or his brother, or, you know what I mean? Like, like, sometimes you got to play ball. Sometimes you got to offer a kid because he's a legacy. It happens. All right. Not every offer is created equal. Not every commitment is created equal.
True. And some schools, some coaches get very proud and do not play that game or say they don't play that game. I remember when I covered Maryland as a student at the University of Maryland a long time ago. Now time flies. There was a situation where Maryland was trying to land Trayvon Diggs, the brother of Stephon Diggs, who had played at Maryland a couple years earlier. They've both made very nice careers for themselves in the NFL. And Trayvon Diggs was very, very tight with a quarterback who was in the DMV area and was like a beloved kind of local legend high school quarterback who all of his peers respected a lot. And this player, Trayvon Diggs, sort of indicated, hey, Maryland, if you offer this guy, you might improve your chances of landing me. Maryland didn't, and Trayvon Diggs went to Alabama. Now, did he go to Alabama because it was Alabama and it's Maryland? Yeah, probably. But I don't know. I sure would have liked to have watched Trayvon Diggs playing in College Park all those years, so don't get too proud. But Richard,
you took the other Diggs from me.
Oh, he's
because Stephon was supposed to go to Florida.
Yeah, no, Stephon Diggs was great at Maryland, including my true freshman year when he caught passes for a full third of a season from a true freshman linebacker who was playing quarterback for the back half of that season. A memory in time. And by the way, something that explains a lot of why I sound so cynical whenever I talk about Maryland football is that that was my first year on campus, and that's what I think of. But in terms of Maryland's Big Ten rivals, a couple of other legacy Big Ten programs with similar places in the conference in its history, Richard, you have a thought about what it means or what it doesn't mean that Michigan is now succeeding to some extent. And by the way, it's not just this player. I think they've been pretty active in Ohio in general over the last few months, and I'm sure it helps to have beaten Ohio State a couple years in a row. You've got thoughts about what it means, what it doesn't, that Michigan is making this incursion across the Toledo border.
Look, what's noteworthy about Jordan Marshall is that he is a player with an Ohio State offer that Ohio State wanted and would have taken, by the way, that Michigan got. That has not happened. It's been like a while. I think it's been like 10 years from what I've seen. It's been a while. So I would say this is a lot more to do with Michigan being serious recruiting wise versus, you know, any sign of Ohio State decline. excuse me. There's a couple things at play here. First and foremost, the young man is from Cincinnati. Cincinnati is not exactly this Ohio State stronghold like you would think it is. Couple different dynamics in Cincinnati. Obviously, its closeness to Louisville and Kentucky. It's a pro town anyway, et cetera. It's a little bit different. It's not exactly in Ohio State's pocket like you might think. I am not saying Ohio State does not get players from Cincinnati. Listen to what I said. The other thing is the running back market this year. There is not, as I understand it, a transcendent running back in this year's recruiting class, at least from a prospect standpoint. Sure, you may get somewhere, may be developed, you may have a Heisman Trophy winner. But there is not in this class what there was last year's class, which is, hey, there's like one or two guys who are like, yo, that's the guy. You've got a bunch of good college player prospects, I should say, good college prospects in this running back market. Ohio State is going to get one of them. They're Ohio State. What this screams to me, though, is Michigan being serious. Michigan just ripped off two playoff berths, and they just signed a recruiting class last year that was like 17th. You can talk about coach him up. Harbaugh is a good football coach, which I believe that he is. Michigan's obviously had a ton of success the last couple years. But what has happened when they've gotten to the precipice of success? They got absolutely smoked by Georgia, and they played, yes, in a classic, but they got beat by a TCU team that they should have had the physical ability to steamroll, given how they were built. So I don't think that, like, Michigan's not a failure, but Michigan has a level it needs to kick on towards. Yes, they have beaten Ohio State, which is a big checkmark in their advancement under Harbaugh. But obviously, there are steps that need to be taken in order for them to go truly where they want to go, which is back to the national championship. Because Michigan now has, I think, firmly asserted and stamped themselves into, seems like, yearly being in the title discussion, given that they can actually now beat Ohio State.
Yeah, and that'll continue forever, because even if Ohio State punches back, they're going to punch back as the sports go into the 12-team playoff. So, yeah, Michigan is going to be in the national title picture forever. In any year that they're not is a policy failure. So I think that things will change. I wonder a bit about what the upside is. And this is an age old college football question, is like, what could Michigan recruiting be? It's a different dynamic than Ohio State, because you are not the only game in town in an entire state. Like, you know, no disrespect to Cincinnati, but even when Cincinnati's in the Big 12, they're not going to be taking players from Ohio State with any regularity. Michigan doesn't quite have that, because they have Ohio State across the border, and also because Michigan State exists. So I don't think that you will ever see Michigan for any extended period of time recruiting like Ohio State has recruited for, well, basically the entire recruiting ratings era. But it is significant, I think, that they're in there. Richard, one thing that you have in our show notes is that Ohio State needs to continue to figure out collectives, name, image, and likeness. What is your assessment of how well that is going based on your survey?
I mean, I think it's a lot better. It's a lot better than what it was this time last summer, but still some road to a ways to go. Ohio State's got like two or three. They're one of those schools that's got a few. I think Ryan Day and that staff are trying to figure out which is the right one to kind of promote and back.
I think they might have picked,
you know, they've
one.
Had sure they've had one that like the head of, on the day CJ Stroud announced he was going to the NFL draft, put out a note that was like, hey, we've got a big announcement. And at that point in time, I had been told by a lot of people that CJ Stroud going to the NFL was not a slam dunk. So in Ohio State-dom, this became a thing of like, oh, they secured the bag and they kept CJ. Obviously they did not. CJ Stroud might end up being a Carolina Panther next season. And this did not reflect well on the collective ecosystem at Ohio State, among other things going on there.
No, the guy who runs it looked very silly that day. I think it wound up that the surprise was like a gender reveal for someone having a baby. Odd the way that played out. That was an interesting couple of days of will or won't he come back, CJ Stroud. I'll get these things wrong plenty in the future, but I never believed it. And I think that it's an important lesson. If you are a quarterback who's going to be a top half of the first round pick, it makes zero sense ever, period, for you to take collective money to come back, because collectives cannot compete with what you're really talking about, which is your second NFL contract that you get to a year sooner if you go into the draft now versus year
number one. I will say.
It would have been madness
I will
for
say
CJ Stroud to come back to college football.
I will say I do buy that CJ Stroud had a legitimate decision and was trying to make a legitimate decision.
Sure. No, I'm sure they made it challenging and they probably tugged on the heartstrings. But just economically, I'm glad that whoever advises him or if he made the decision all on his own, I'm like, economically, it just makes way more sense if you're that kind
sure.
of quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah, from an economic perspective, but CJ's a competitor, and I know that he has had some unfinished business at Ohio State. Didn't win a national championship, didn't beat Michigan as a starter. Like, you know, there were some things that he felt he left on the table, and there were some legitimate things that were tugging at some heartstrings and tugging at some emotions, for him to come back and finish his career and, you know, come out next year. But, you know, we'll see. Enjoy being a Panther. But look, I don't, Ohio State's not done because of this. This is much more about Michigan than it is about Ohio State. I think what we have here is we are always going to batch. Look, Michigan got a player from Ohio. Like, I'm not saying we're like making up a story that's not there. But I do think you're always going to batch these two programs because of what they are. Because of the rivalry, all that kind of stuff, where sometimes there's merit to it and sometimes there's not. And I don't think this is necessarily a commentary on where Ohio State is going or even where Michigan is going. I think Michigan got a good player from Ohio. And eventually, law of averages wise, that was going to happen.
Yeah, I think it was probably inevitable that it was going to happen at some point. We'll see where it leads. Also, Richard, you had alluded to something that you think Ohio State's collective situation is a lot better than it was a year ago. Walk quickly, because I think I had a lingering question about that. Walk out what that means. Walk out what disarray looks like for any collective, not just Ohio State, and then what it looks like when things are getting organized, competent, buttoned up.
I mean, disarray looks like the State University of Florida based in Gainesville over the last couple months, if you want to be honest about it. How much disarray there totally? So when we talk about disarray, like Florida's Gator Collective did 140 however many deals that were perfect, went off without a cinch, player got the money, whatever. The 150th they did turned up into a Jaden Rashada blow up. So that's what chaos can look like. I just think Ohio State was at a point where Ryan Day and that staff knew we need an amount of money to compete with not Michigan, not Penn State, Alabama, Texas. Like that's who, obviously, that is who is in Ohio State's part of the cul-de-sac. Well, maybe not Texas from success.
Money-wise. Texas, you're rich. That's what he's saying.
Money-wise. You know, and so I think, you know, being in the Big Ten, you got some snootiness towards the collective aspect of things. You've got some unseriousness towards the collective aspect of things as far as doing business the way it's really supposed to be done in order to win a championship. If you want to have a okay, tap you on the hat collective structure, okay, congratulations. You want to get dirty? You want to play championship football? You want to recruit business the way it's supposed to be done. That's what Ohio State felt it needed to do. I just think they had, I would think they would tell you the landscape was too splintered. Like when you've got three, like Texas had five at one point in time. I don't know if they still do or not. Texas had five collectives. Like Florida's got three. Yeah, Florida State, fits. I think, has two now. Like, you know,
by the way, athletic directors do not like that. They do not like that at all. And there have been a couple of them have been pretty public about this. Like USC was pretty annoyed when there were several proliferating at once.
Right.
I remember having a conversation with Boise State's athletic director, Jeremiah Dickey, for a story I was writing a couple months ago. He's like, I'd like fewer cooks in the kitchen. Everyone would like
especially fewer third party cooks in the kitchen.
Yes. Fewer third party cooks in the kitchen. If you're an athletic director, what you really want is a collective that is run one collective. You want exactly one if you can help it, that has all of the muscle of your fan base behind it, and that is led by someone who, you know, doesn't seem like a dumbass to you. Like the best.
Like I could tell you.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say your example is well taken, because like I was going to tell you Like, there is a Power 5 school that I won't name that I talked to somebody who was like, yeah, dude, we got two. One of them sucks. we want to disincentivize that one. And we're kind of saying you should structure it like that so that in the long term it nerfs it so that we can actually put resources behind the one we care about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that the one that Ohio State has backed that Ryan Day and Chris Holtman are in a video for this week, the same week, by the way, that they had this recruiting L in football in Michigan, is led by someone with the last name, like Schottenstein, right? Like, it's like that big money family that's name is on a bunch of stuff at Ohio State. Like, you know, you want people that you are connected to. I go back to Boise, this guy I was talking with their AD about it. Like, their athletic collective is led by someone who used to work as like an associate AD for Boise State. So he has like
UCF just did.
Oh, yep.
UCF yep. just did basically the same
yep.
thing.
They brought up Sean Tuohy, right? Who was like chief of staff to Gus. And it's like, you want someone with a cursory understanding of compliance. What you don't want, for instance, you don't want like a Miami situation. Well, you do from the money perspective, but like, you don't want someone who's going to be like waving around a sign that says like, hi, enforcement, come get a motel room down the street. Like,
George's collective is run by a former compliance guy at both West Virginia and Tennessee.
It's smart. It's a smart way to do business. If we're setting apart the ones that are run well from the ones that are not. And I think Ohio State might be getting to the point of having one that is run well and that they feel comfortable with if you just look at it from afar. Richard, we've got some things to move on to with the National Collegiate Athletic Association, but quickly, some podcast business, some things to talk about this week. Both Ohio State and Michigan are valued apparel partners of Home Field Apparel, are our own longest standing podcast business partners and dear friends of ours who we saw a couple weeks ago in Indianapolis. If you go to homefieldapparel.com, you can find Buckeye stuff, Wolverine stuff, and, well, dozens of other school stuff. You can also find Split Zone Duo stuff. You go Split Zone Duo Home Field, it'll come right up. Use the promo code SCD20, that's SCD20, and you get 20% off your first order. If you have not yet ordered with Homefield, now as good a time as ever. You will not be dissatisfied with what you get from the finest provider of collegiate vintage officially licensed apparel in all the land. And you also have an opportunity to be a mercenary, as I am. And you can pick a school that's in the Final Four right now. You can pretend, for instance, that you have been a lifelong SDSU fan, or that you have been, I know that Kansas State got knocked out, but Kansas State is a huge home field school. Kansas State fans go nuts for home field. If you want to give credence, to the great run by the Wildcats, I think their head coach, Jerome Tang, was actually wearing Kansas State home field stuff, like during his like broadcast interviews, during multiple the course times. Of K-State's run. So yeah, all kinds of exciting stuff.
He actually told me that it's one of his favorite sweatshirts and that he loves home field. So I'm serious. I'm not even doing a bit.
No.
Like I talked to Jerome Tang at Madison Square Garden last weekend.
Dude, athletic directors and athletic department staff. I should say athletic department staff. I don't talk to a ton of ADs about their fashion choices. But like, if you work in college sports, like the people who are the rank and file who make athletic departments run from day to day, we meet a lot of them whenever we have like these events, like we had in Indianapolis, because a lot of them listen to the show. Like, they love home field, and it's a lot more fun to wear home field stuff than it is to wear like whatever your Nike or your Under Armour or your like dry fit is that gets sent to you that you pull out of the equipment closet.
As someone who has facilitated the acquisition of home field merchandise to a prominent athletic director. Yeah, man. They're in the tank for home field too. It's comfortable stuff, man.
Richard is in the business of facilitating acquisitions of all kinds of goods. He's not going to say the other ones.
Call me a bag man, Alex.
He's a bag man.
An apparel bag man.
Homefieldapparel.com. Again, the code is SCD20. Thanks a ton to Homefield. Also, we've got some exciting stuff happening throughout this spring in our own world here at Split Zone Duo. We have a number of shows up just from the last couple of weeks on the Split Zone Duo Patreon, which is at splitzoneduo.com. We have one from our dear Stephen Godfrey that we are anticipating will be up later this week. that I think a lot of people have been waiting for and that I am very excited for. You will obviously see us promoting the Dickens out of that when that is published. We expect that that will be in very short order. And we got more stuff. We actually, the three of us were in the same place last week. Richard and Godfrey came to DC. That's why we did not have a big show recording last week. And we were plotting the future and not in the interest of being overly cagey, because if you're listening to the show, I regard you as a stakeholder in the show. So we'll share more soon, but I'm excited. We've got like new programming coming for you, new shows that are going to be largely on the Splits Into a Patreon for as little as $5 a month. It's a great deal. But also here on the free show, some new ideas. So we're very excited. We think that 2023 is going to be our best year yet. And that's all thanks to you. And by you, I mean all of you, listeners to the show. We appreciate you. And Godfrey will be back soon. Richard, you want to talk about the NCAA?
No.
He does, folks. He's excited. This is the kind of thing that really gets him going. But we do not do a ton of following every single thing, every twist and turn in the NCAA's continuing fight for bureaucratic dominance in the world, because we are not a trade publication and we don't want to bore you. And this stuff moves really slowly, like really, really slowly. Like maybe you've noticed that Congress and or that the NCAA has been asking Congress for certain things for years, plural now, and still not gotten them. In fact, there's been no college athletics reform bill passed or even progressed seriously through either chamber of Congress in all of these last few years that there has been so much hand-wringing about it. It goes slow, but there is some stuff happening this week, and we think it's a good occasion to sort of do a level set on where we are. Richard has done a ton of reporting on this for Sports Illustrated, so he's very authoritative on it. I am, of course, a huge authority on it, which you know because I'm cited in the footnotes, Richard, of the of the House subcommittee documents today. So, I mean, I basically control Congress. So, if anyone wants to get any bills passed, any lobbyists who might want to pump some money into Split Zone Duo in exchange for legislative favor making, we can certainly talk about that if you're interested.
You live in D.C.
Yep.
Like you are a Capitol Hill insider, man.
Yep.
You like Split Zone Duo is a think tank.
Yep.
Sorry.
Yep. Absolutely.
What publication? What was it? A freelance article?
That's all my articles these days. Yeah, this was a freelance story that I wrote for Global Sport Matters. If you Google my name in Global Sport Matters, you'll find it. Just about the. It was actually kind of diving into the world of collectives. You know, all of the ins and outs that led to the Jaden Rashada mess, for instance, that you mentioned, but that have also changed college football and college sports economics in general. Can definitely read that if you're interested. Did a lot of research and conversation with people for that story. But on the NCAA, as we sort of spin forward what is happening this week and why we're going to talk about it, NCAA for basically the last decade, since the Ed O'Bannon case, has been in a constant state of fighting for its legal and political life. And generally, it has not gone well for the NCAA. Of course, it still exists. You know, the Final Four is still happening this weekend. It's still called the NCAA tournament. But the NCAA has taken some very big L's in the legal arena and one more in the political arena. The O'Bannon case ended in 2015. Ed O'Bannon, former UCLA basketball player, that did away with national caps on cost of attendance payouts, which are now a regular feature, particularly in the Power Five, of how athletes are compensated when they go to a school. The Alston case, very famously. Richard, remember the margin of that one at the Supreme Court? Can you help me out remembering what the NCAA's margin was there? Votes for and votes against.
Sources tell me they got shut out. If you check with your people and mine, they'd say they got beaten 9-0.
Tough day. Very tough day. And certain justices of the court seem to be chomping at the bit to do even further damage, though, of course, concurring opinions, we know, do not have the force of law that the majority opinion does, as Brett Kavanaugh wrote one in 2021.
Yeah, what he's talking about, I think, is an interesting thing, because both of us, a lot of in the ways we talk about this, we point to Brett Kavanaugh's opinion, deservedly so. I mean, he's a justice on the Supreme Court, and he wrote an absolute humdinger of an opinion about the NCAA, its future, et cetera, et cetera. But I had a conversation with somebody who actually was like, not pouring cold water on that thing, but we were having a conversation about, you know, he wrote that concurring opinion because he felt so strongly and so passionately about it. I think a lot of people have said, a lot of people have framed Brett Kavanaugh's, and myself included, Brett Kavanaugh's concurring opinion as like a bring it on to anybody who wants to file suit against the NCAA or whatever. It may be that. It may be that. But it also may be Brett Kavanaugh feels so strongly about this and the other eight justices do not, given they did not sign on to said concurring opinion.
Yep, absolutely true. I think you're right that it was talked about, maybe including by me, more as focusing on the one than on the eight who didn't. And I think the NCAA would like you to focus on the eight who did not. They have made that case in public before. But so that was the second L, Alston after O'Bannon. And then in the political arena, because it never really got to courts, name, image, and likeness and the world of collectives that exists now. I don't know if you heard, Richard, but players can be paid now by third parties to participate in college athletics.
Of college sports as we know it, Alex.
It's this new
thing. End of college sports as we know it.
So those are the three big L's so far. And they have changed college sports quite a bit in ways we've already talked about on the show. Collective world exists. Alston payments exist. Alston payments are, you know, the colloquial description for the nearly $6,000 a year that schools can give to athletes in education related benefits, as awards, basically for keeping up with your coursework or participating in certain programs or passing classes or whatever. This has all changed college sports quite a bit already, but there's blood in the water still. And I think that people in Congress are, well, I'm saying they're not done yet. They haven't really started yet because they haven't passed any laws, but they are still interested, or at least interested in giving the appearance that they might deal with college sports reform in some way or another. And this is a big week because there is the first hearing on college sports matters, if you will, of the new Congress that took effect in January, and the first one since Charlie Baker, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts. So the former centrist Democratic governor of Massachusetts took over as president of the NCAA. Hearing is Wednesday morning. In full disclosure, we are recording this on the eve of that hearing. Charlie Baker won't be there, but the show will go on. Richard, set the stage. Give me the game preview, the Vegas lines, et cetera, on this, you know, tete-a-tete going on on Capitol Hill.
Okay, so a few things here. We need to understand and talk about what this is. You may have seen Jack Swarbrick, for instance, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week.
Notre Dame's AD. With the president.
Yes. With the president of Notre Dame as well. First of all, about that. That was not just Swarbrick and the AD and the president of Notre Dame doing that. Bomani Jones had one earlier in the week. If you know anything about Bomani, you know Bomani's standpoint. If you have seen anything around Jack Swarbrick's comments, you understand his standpoint. Now, I will say, to Jack's credit, Notre Dame's credit, that op-ed, and I don't want to go all the way into that, but that op-ed was, in my opinion, some of the old hand-wringing, but sort of like pushed forward, right? Like the old hand-wringing was like, this is going to ruin college sports. We can't pay them at all. Jack Swarbrick's op-ed was like, this is going to ruin college sports. We need to figure out a better way to pay them, by the way. Like Swarbrick in that was like, amateurism is dumb. Why did we do it? So, okay. What that
And also, was, how can we perpetuate it as best we can?
Sure. What that was part of what I think this week is a continuation of, which is we are level setting this discussion for not college sports people. You listening to this podcast are not the intended audience of either of those op-eds or tomorrow's Wednesday's congressional hearing. Wednesday's congressional hearing is so that members of Congress know what's going on from a couple standpoints. Let's start with why Charlie Baker has this job, because why he has this job and what he's doing in this job are going to kind of inform what tomorrow is. Yes, he is not going to be there, but he started in the job. He started March 1st. Why he has the job is basically because he can go to Washington. You will note Charlie Baker is not moving to Indianapolis, where the NCAA's headquarters are based. He is staying in, well, he's from outside of Boston or lives outside of Boston. He's staying outside of Boston so that he can have ease of access to get to DC as well, because he is going to go to Capitol Hill to lobby Capitol Hill. In the you know, broader suite of NCAA lobbying legislative efforts. He's already done this. He's already met with some members of Congress over the last couple of weeks. My dear colleague Ross Dellinger at Sports Illustrated actually reported on that towards the end of last week. Charlie Baker's mandate is to get us some sort of federal bill. The level of omnibus that bill is, I think we'll get to in a second. But get us some congressional help. Why? Well, the NCAA's chief legal argument in some cases that we're about to talk about as well is, yo, bros, chill out for a second. Don't rule in favor of the plaintiffs that are against us. We got this. We can handle this. The handle this part of the discussion, Alex, is going to Capitol Hill. Now, the NCAA are going to DC. The NCAA has a problem, though. The NCAA has not been able to tell you, member of Congress, in an efficient elevator pitch, what they want and need from you, member of Congress, and you, Congress, as a body. Part of that is because members of Congress have a lot to deal with. You know, they do not sit and think about the intricacies of college sports all day, obviously. The other thing is that the NCAA just has not had a coherent message about what it is they want and need. That is a problem. That is something Charlie Baker has identified as a problem as he has started the job. So part of this is level setting with Congress. If you're a member of Congress, you can watch this hearing and you can at least get a 30,000 foot view about what we're talking about, in air quotes, regarding what is needed and necessary from Congress regarding college sports.
Quick series of questions from me based on what you just said. When you say, hey, the NCAA's goal is to look to courts and look to the broader legal world and say, hey, don't find against us on any of the cases that, by the way, we're about to talk about, because we got this, we're working on this. I assume what you're alluding to is that they would like an exemption from antitrust law. Is that correct, generally speaking? That seems to be a fairly known thing that they would want. They claim they want it to be limited, but is that what you're talking about?
Yes. I think the easiest kind of way to say that, answer that question is yes. Yes, the answer to your question is yes. But what solution we get out of this, I'm not entirely sure. First of all, if you get an antitrust exemption, you have to give for that, right? The NFL has an antitrust exemption, which is why they're able to have a salary cap, which is an artificial cap on wages. It's a salary cap. They're able to have a salary cap because they gave. What did they give, among other things? Well, the NFL will not have a game on a Friday night ever for now because
on a Saturday.
It wants to keep its because on a Saturday when college football is happening, because they want to keep their antitrust exemption. To get, you have to give. Now, what the NCAA is going to have to give, I don't know. I think as far as easy wins that I think we can get our arms around, maybe long-term medical care for athletes is one. NIL cap, NIL regulations, I don't know. Because you have Republicans who are like, straight-laced, streamlined NIL bill. That's what we're going to do. Or NIL law. That's what we're going to do. But then you have Democrats on the other side saying, hey, we need to strike while the iron is hot. Not just NIL. We need to have long-term medical care. We need to have insurance moving forward. We need to have mental health services. We need all something a little bit more omnibus. Think of like an athlete's bill of rights.
Yeah, this has been – so I'll make a few points. I think Matt Brown in his Indispensable Extra Points newsletter made a good point kind of via a close reading of the Swarbrick Jenkins Times piece that I think one of the signals that might be being sent in that story, in that op-ed, is that in Swarbrick's view, in Jenkins' view, maybe some limits on travel, maybe some limits on practice time so that athletes spend more time in the dining halls and the dorms, that might be a give. Okay, like – sure. I don't think that's the give that most people are looking for, and I don't think it will be sufficient. The reason that I do not think it will be sufficient, and you're alluding to this here, this has been a shockingly bipartisan cross-ideological issue for a few years now. for now, for a few years. That has manifested politically with Republican and Democratic state houses and governors alike passing very similar bills on name, image, and likeness. And it manifested, though they are not tied together exactly in their different issues, in the courts and in the Supreme Court, where you get a 9-0. You don't get a ton of 9-0s in the Supreme Court, though you do get them from time to time. I think those days are ending, of Republicans and Democrats seeing this the same. Name, image, and likeness was easy because Republicans could look at it as a free market issue and Democrats could look at it as a racial justice, social justice, worker rights, fairness issue. And so you got this burgeoning national consensus for a few years about the very narrow issue of whether athletes should be able to get paid by third parties. I think what we are starting to see and are going to see over the coming years is Democrats acting like Democrats and Republicans acting like Republicans on the matter of labor rights, as this becomes a more straightforward labor rights issue where, you know, the battle shifts to whether athletes are employees, whether they are entitled to compensation, not from third parties, but from their schools themselves or their athletic departments themselves. And I just don't know how that's all going to play with what the NCAA would like. You know, Bernie Sanders and Chris Murphy, his Democratic colleague from Connecticut, and even Joe Biden, because his labor allies are not going to like it if he were to do this, are not going to just let the NCAA do whatever it wants with players' employment status or lack thereof. They're not going to just say, hey, sure, you can do this and we'll make it a federal statute that you can cap compensation forever and not get sued on it. It's not going to happen. By the same token, I don't think Republicans are going to be like, all right, well, time to make sure all of these athletes, for my beloved Vols or Gators or whoever, or Buckeyes or Wolverines or whoever, have to be paid by the school. Because these are not traditionally things that the Republican Party supports. Workers getting paid more money, or being entitled to things they haven't been entitled to from their boss. Not historically Republican stronghold things that they like to advocate for. So I just think that the days of consensus on this between the two parties, as the issue shifts from NIL to more complex labor law issues, are over. I don't think the consensus is going to exist for a lot longer.
So tomorrow at the congressional hearings, who is speaking here and what they're saying is going to be interesting. So the Patriot League commissioner is talking. Washington State's AD is talking. Trey Burton, who actually used to play at Florida and played for the Eagles for a little bit. His brother also played at Florida. Trey is still kind of in touch with Florida. His name's on the tight end room, that kind of stuff. They're on the docket to speak. As well as Kaylee Mudge, who is a Florida State softball player. By the way, the ranking Republican on this committee is from Gainesville, went to Florida, and represents a district that's a little bit north of Tampa. So if you don't think NIL is something he at least has an idea about, you would be sorely mistaken. Also speaking, Virginia State, which is an HBCU, their school president, Dr. Makol Abdullah, and Jason Stahl, who is the head of the College Football Players Association. You may remember them from, there was a thing last summer with Sean Clifford, Penn State, and the Big Ten that Jason Stahl was in the middle of. Stahl is speaking at this hearing as well. What you're going to get from most of these people when they speak is a lobbying for, at least in their oral, you know, testimony, is asking for some type of federal legislation or uniform legislation about NIL overall. I've read the written testimonies. That's what most of them are going to say and ask for. The Patriot League commissioner is probably going to say, if we make them employees, we're going to drop sports, which I don't think she's lying about, by the way. I think if Pat Shun says that, he's fibbing, but I don't think the Patriot League is fibbing when they say that. But, From where Jason Stahl is concerned, I think Jason Stahl is going to come in and say something that's a lot more omnibus, or at least answer the questions, proposing something that's a lot more omnibus. I don't think he wants, you know, the federal government to be saying and pointing out every single thing. I think it behooves him and his organization to have a more state-by-state kind of patchwork, because something federal, something that's ironclad, hard and fast, that's not bargaining. And he is the head of a players association. He would like to bargain.
Richard, one thing about the patchwork point and state-by-state differences and like the desire for uniformity, hasn't it become kind of irrelevant?
Depends on who you ask.
So my view of this would be that it made some sense like a year and a half ago to want there to be some national standard for what this would all look like because different states were passing laws that looked much different. Like not much different, but different in serious ways around things like reporting requirements to your school and the ability to use a school's marks, for instance, in your dealings. So there were differences, and you know, there were also just some states where these laws have been passed, making the NCAA's rules illegal, and some where they hadn't. So, okay, like it made sense at that time. Sure, like whatever it is, it should be national. It should be uniform. But it turns out that in practice, is there much difference at all between one state's NIL law and another state's NIL law? Are there any enforcement mechanisms in place that effectively on the ground make one state's law different than another now that the NCAA has instituted this sort of hands-off national posture toward it? I don't think so. I don't.
I think that is a hard question to answer because you will have people in the same state that disagree on the answer to that question. Like, I know, the University of Florida views its state law a little bit differently than Florida State does. And those are two brands in that state that are of similar footing, right? Make no mention of Ohio State versus Toledo. You know what I'm saying? Like I don't even know if Ohio has a state law, but you know what I mean. It's a hard question to answer, to be honest with you. It is. Now, your point about enforcement is well taken, though. Who the hell's enforcing it is, it's almost a separate discussion because of the lack thereof happening. But, you know, you're going to have some schools that are going to be a little reticent to toe the line on a state law, and you're going to have others who are going to be, you know, more willing to flaunt. And that's going to happen within each state.
Richard, that's the picture for now with the legislative effort and the NCAA, Charlie Baker, not literally going to Capitol Hill this week, but going to Capitol Hill to try to get some help. We also want to quickly go over the current legal headwinds. Quickly, we are not going to become a lawsuits podcast, but they're going on, and you have done in particular on one of them, the Johnson v. NCAA case, though I don't think you are the plaintiff.
Right.
There are three.
Maybe I am. Who knows?
Three going on right now. I'm not going to say they're all equally big. I think it goes kind of in order, 1, 2, 3, how big they are, and we'll get to. But give me the elevator pitch on the Johnson v. NCAA case that I'm sure people have seen referenced on Twitter, that maybe they've read a thing or two about, maybe by you, in fact, in the pages of SI. And just give me the quick overview of why this is important and what is happening.
The first and foremost, level setting. Timeline. Not happening anytime soon. Like, this is, we're talking a year. Change and change. Johnson versus NCAA is basically a group of athletes suing to be made, at minimum wage employees of the school and the NCAA in a joint employer relationship. That is what the plaintiffs are asking. You would do it on basically your practice time, the 20-hour rule, so-called, and the time you spent in competition. So you would pay me minimum wage for those hours. That is what they are asking for. Yes, it seems low level, low lift, low hanging fruit. It kind of is. On the NCAA school side, employing anybody, athlete or otherwise, is not just their wage. There are I'm not talking about tax implications for the athlete. It's minimum wage. The tax is whatever. I'm talking about the tax implications for the school. There are tax implications for the school. There are benefit implications for the school. Yada, yada, yada. I'm not going to go all the way down there, but you get it. Right now, where the case is at right now is the plaintiffs are trying to get a test, what is called a multi-factor test, run by the courts. And the plaintiffs are confident that when you run that test, you will find that athletes are doing work commensurate that should be compensated. That is at base level.
The test is, are you an employee? It's an are you an employee test.
virtually based on five or six factors, you want to call it.
Good.
The NCAA is saying, don't do that. You don't need to run a test. You never run a test. Don't do it. What we are specifically, the point we're at right now is that we're at a break point in the case where the NCAA is basically saying we do not need to run a test. If you, and not even they'll fail the test or pass the test. It's we don't need to run a test. If the plaintiffs prevail in the current juncture of the case, we will then run the test. It is going to take a matter of months to decide the specific question, should a test be run? Yes, it's a technicality, but welcome to your legal system at work.
Welcome to the legal system at work. Okay. I think I understand it. We've got a slow developing case that if things went a certain way would threaten to get at least a significant section of college athletes classified as employees. Top line headline, all of correct? Them. Good.
All of them.
Every one of them. Okay. Because that's something that's differentiating. Okay. Good. Yeah. If, that's yes, Johnson yeah, v. NCAA.
It would be everybody. If the plaintiffs prevail.
Second case. We're going to do three. Actually, four legal matters, kind of three cases here. House v. NCAA. Richard, you told me yesterday when I was sitting on the phone talking to you in prep for this episode that the NCAA is scared shitless about this one. But it also strikes me as a little bit of a different issue and maybe a little bit less existential in nature to the Johnson case about employment status. What is it about the House v. NCAA case that inspires that brand of fear that you mentioned to me?
It's literally just a dollar sign. Like, basically, House v. NCAA is about whether I, as a college athlete, have missed out on wages. Excuse me, I shouldn't even say wages. Whether I, as a college athlete, have missed out on money because I was not allowed to be paid my name, image, and likeness for however long. The time horizon of that case.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, the time horizon on that is the issue. That's what they're worried about. Because if you say we're going back 5 years, that's one thing. If you say we're going back 10 years, that's another. If you say 50, like the amount of money is just so hard to predict here. That's where I use the word. That's what they're scared shitless about.
One of the plaintiffs in this case, House v. NCAA, is Sedona Prince, a women's basketball player at Oregon over the last few years, who, if you'll remember, has like a huge TikTok presence, like significant social media following, so could argue that her earnings in the pre-NIL era were severely restricted by the NCAA not allowing that kind of payment. Also, Prince has kind of been a righteous antagonist, I would say, of the NCAA, was one of the players who brought a lot of attention in 2020 during the bubbled basketball tournaments to the disparities between the men's and women's setups that they had. I guess those tournaments would have been in the spring of 2021. So significant, and we'll see where it leads, could lead to a huge dollar sign. Richard, that case is also a while from being finalized, settled, verdicted, settled.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there's also that. And then there's this third case, that I actually completely forgot about because as far as like top line existential threats of the NCAA, that's about like baseball coaches, which is not the biggest deal in the world in the broader sense of college athletics. I'm sure baseball coaches are not exactly thrilled about it.
Yeah. I actually asked a sports lawyer about this one, just kind of running a theory past them the other night, and I'm not sure this is true, but it could be true. It wouldn't surprise me. This case is about the NCAA's bylaws for baseball coaches saying you can have three paid and one unpaid baseball coach. And the unpaid coaches, some of them, you might not be surprised to hear, say that they have done work that is basically like full-time work, not volunteer work, and that they have not been paid for it, and that they've been misclassified, and that in the course of that, their future earnings will be depressed because they're based on prior earnings. On the surface, very narrow baseball case, but also, we have seen from the O'Bannon case and the Austin case how one legal loss in antitrust can beget another one, and one thing can lead to another. They are building blocks for future cases to be built on top of each other. an antitrust ruling for volunteer baseball coaches could lead to who knows what. One of the things that struck me was that in the couple of weeks after this suit was filed, you saw the NCAA apparently table a proposal that has been in the works to allow analysts in football, the sport that we cover, to do on-field coaching. And it crossed my mind that perhaps there is some worry about if that happens, maybe there would be some people who have argued that they have been doing this kind of work and that they have been being paid as analysts when they should be being paid as coaches. It crossed the mind. I think the NCAA is probably worried about this case, but a little bit less so than the other two because it's less fundamental to the whole college sports model and doesn't have the massive, massive dollar sign next to it. And also, Richard, there is a National Labor Relations Board matter going right now with USC. The NLRB is very activist right now under the Biden administration. If you're a big unions person, then this is very exciting. This is an area where the administration has just been very, very aggressive, in this case via the general counsel of the NLRB, Jennifer Abruzzo, who has been on this program, by the way, a little bit more than a year ago. A lot has to happen here. And again, this is all kind of boring because it's a long way from fruition. But the NLRB, sort of in HQ, has told one of the NLRB's field offices to go and argue in an administrative court that USC has unlawfully restricted the economic rights of football, men's basketball, and women's basketball players. Why USC? Because it is a private school, and the NLRB can only hit private schools. It does not control, does not have jurisdiction in public sector labor relations. So this is not the same, by the way, as like Northwestern in 2015. When players wanted a union and the NLRB had to rule on whether they were employees entitled to vote on one, it's a different thing. It's a less straightforward administrative process. Ramoki Huma's group, the National College Players Association, there are a couple of these groups floating around, is working with the NLRB on an unfair labor practice charge against USC because implicit in finding that USC had engaged in unfair labor practices would be finding that the athletes are employees that are entitled to more than they've gotten. The NCAA would, of course, appeal that, and it would then wind its way through the federal court system. Nothing happens quickly in this world. So a long road ahead, but we have yet one other area of the NCAA getting yelled at. So Richard, that's a summation. You got one case where there is an active effort to get athletes classified as employees, all of them. You've got one where the NCAA is being sued for a ton of money for past behavior. You've got one narrow antitrust issue that you never know what it could lead to around baseball coaches. And you've got USC in the crosshairs of a federal entity that is trying to expand labor rights for college athletes.
Yeah.
Last question for you.
Jennifer Abruzzo may rule that all athletes may be, or excuse me, all private school athletes are able to be paid. You know, this is not all of it. There is others to it. But this is kind of the broad suite of what you would say, probably the most top line things. And again, especially where those court cases are concerned, the NCAA's chief legal defense boils down to rule in favor of us, the NCAA, so that we can go to Congress and effectively control the messaging, the package, the, all this kind of stuff. It's going to be a long road. We're going to continue. We're going to continue doing this for quite some time. I do not expect some bill to come out of what happens tomorrow. Tomorrow is level setting. Tomorrow is introduction. Tomorrow is college sports in 2023 for dummies. The dummies being multiple members of Congress.
Richard, 1 to 10. How screwed is the NCAA? I'm going 6. I think they're in a spiral, but whether it's a death spiral depends on a few things.
I mean, the difference is how much they're actually fucked versus what they say. And as always, college sports is a business that will adapt to whatever changes happen. Like, the NCAA has been in peril. You could have written that headline any single point in time over the last 70 odd years since the NCAA took legitimate, you know, noteworthy power. I mean, they were writing about that in the 1910s and the 1920s, about college sports is in peril and college sports is changing, all that kind of stuff. That's why the, like, college sports is at a crossroads thing is sort of is falling on, is starting to fall a lot more on deaf ears than I think it ever has, in my opinion, because at the end of the day, you will adapt. Because at the end of the day, there is way too much money at stake for these public universities, at least Division I FBS level. Yes. Do I think the Pat League may drop sports to club level if athletes are employees? Yeah, I think that's, I think, a reasonable thing. But is Washington State going to cut football? No, Washington State is not cutting football. That is not going to happen, no matter how much vetching happens on Capitol Hill tomorrow. I think they will adjust. I think they will adapt. There's too much money at stake to leave it all on the table and cut sports, for instance, in the most sky is falling rhetoric from some parts of college athletics.
You heard it here first, folks. Washington State not cutting football.